Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. Additional support for The Pulse is provided by AstraZeneca and Independence Blue Cross.
You're opening a medical bill and you're thinking, okay, how bad can it be? Bad. Very bad. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
Pulse. There is this myth that scientific progress is achieved by some sort of a direct march to the truth.
I think sometimes I meet scientists, and when they hear what I do, they're a little afraid.
They will eject their entire digestive tract, and then they will grow a brand new one.
Weird ideas are all over the place.
So the question is, why?
What are we always so against?
What do you get for having a bigger brain?
Well, you'll probably
hear the sound of a lot of rushing water dripping.
Who say zero?
On today's show, should we offer cash for organs? One transplant recipient says yes. Is crashing galaxies together on a massive computer really a job? It is. And a look at standing desks. Are they really making us healthier? But first up, if you have health insurance, you still get a bunch of extra medical bills, copays, stuff that wasn't covered all the way. But you don't exactly expect to get a bill for $32,000. But it could happen to you. Do I have your attention now? Take a listen to this story, which involves some really terrible timing, but also some really great timing. Here's Alana Gordon with more.
Michael Trost thought it was pneumonia. He wasn't feeling right. It was March. It was cold outside. Pneumonia.
I was very out of breath. I was coughing.
But
I also knew I had to be at work.
Michael's 52. He hasn't had any major health issues. He lives near the Poconos and is a wood finisher. The shop was expecting an important order that week. Fixtures for a jewelry store. So he made an appointment with his doctor.
For the following week.
But his wife of 17 years, Susan Rosowski, an English professor, noticed he was getting worse.
We tried to go for a walk with the dog, and Mike couldn't even go, 10 feet from the car?
Yeah, that was bad.
This is where both Michael and Susan say they lucked out. Michael's furniture order was delayed. So he had a break.
So I said to Susan, why don't you just drop me at the emergency room?
That was the point when he said, I think maybe, why don't you just drive me to the emergency room? You can do your grocery shopping.
While you do your shopping, they'll give me a chest x-ray, they'll give me antibiotics, and I'll be on my way. But that's not what happened.
Over the next few days, Michael went from a seemingly healthy guy to being nearly immobile on a hospital bed, getting tests, pokes, injections, and perhaps most uncomfortable of all, balloon pump up an artery.
They said that I needed heart surgery, and I'm like, heart surgery? Yeah, they said, there's a valve problem.
A mitral valve defect.
The blood is backing up. Your heart is pumping really hard, and it's not working.
It was a complete surprise.
Who would have thought?
I was overwhelmed. Honestly, I was overwhelmed.
There wasn't much time to react. The hospital transferred Michael to a bigger hospital for the surgery. And just days later, doctors sawed open his sternum and repaired the valve. He headed home just a few days later.
I feel an enormous sense of gratefulness that we dodged so many bullets in terms of how this scenario panned out.
And just months before the surgery, Susan had finally landed a full-time teaching gig with good health insurance for the two of them. That was after years of having bare-boned health plans or none at all. But a couple weeks after the surgery, bills and the explanation of benefits started coming in.
So I started reading them and I was like, this is weird.
They'd made a point to check and go to hospitals that were in their insurance network. But bills are complicated. She thought she must have missed something and owed a few hundred dollars here or there. But then came this one.
Then the bill for $32,000 came in.
The surgeon.
Yeah, the heart surgeon who had operated on Mike.
Turns out the cardiologist, Dr. Arthur Ng, was not in their insurance network, even though the hospital was. Dr. Ng, who's based in Hackensack, New Jersey, did not respond to interview requests. The insurance company, United Health, sent Michael a check for what it deemed a reasonable rate for the procedure, $4,000, meaning Michael and Susan were on the hook for the rest, about $28,000.
You know, I guess in my naive view of health insurance, I had felt that because we were in network that everything was taken care of.
And with that began a new kind of stress.
I just got back on my feet in terms of employment last year. We went through 401k money in order to stay afloat, you know. We couldn't have afforded this chunk of money.
Susan and Michael received what many refer to as a surprise medical bill or a balance bill, meaning you owe the balance. Dr. Kelly Kiyonko researches this practice at New York University.
$32,000 is a lot.
Kiyonko says it's hard to know what the cost of a typical surprise bill might be, and it's unclear how often it happens.
However, I don't think that the situation in general is rare.
Kiyonko says surprise billing occurs when a patient is billed for the difference of what the doctor charges and what the insurer is willing to pay. This only happens when a provider is not covered as part of the insurance plan, when they're out of network. Kiyonko gives a personal example.
I remember the day very vividly.
July 31st, 2 years ago, it was the day she gave birth to her son at a hospital that was covered under her insurance. Knowing about balance billing, she asked more questions than a typical patient.
My husband was laughing because when the anesthesiologist came in to put in the epidural, I asked him specifically if he took my insurance, and the anesthesiologist was kind of floored. I don't think he'd ever gotten that question before. And he kind of fumbled and said, well, you can check the website. I think I do. And I don't really know if I was in any condition to be checking the website in between contractions. But he, in the end, did take my insurance. And so it was quite a surprise to me that the pediatrician, in fact, did not.
Turns out one of the doctors didn't take her insurance and later billed her for $600. It might seem counterintuitive that a doctor and a hospital don't always take the same insurance. Jack Hoadley, a researcher at Georgetown, says that's the reality of healthcare in the U.S.
We have a fragmented healthcare system where different kinds of physicians, different kinds of providers make their own decisions of which insurance networks to belong to.
Hoadley says it's an economic negotiation. Insurers may offer doctors lower payments in exchange for directing more patients to their practice. That might be appealing.
But the question is, how much lower than their regular rates are they willing to accept to create that relationship?
Sometimes the two sides can't agree or don't want to. And so that's when patients find themselves in the crossfire. Hoadley and others think these situations could become more common, especially as more insurance plans tighten their networks. But about a dozen states have some kind of protection in place, mostly for emergency room situations. New York recently enacted what Hoadley describes as the strongest, most comprehensive set of rules to date. Matt Anderson is with the state's Financial Services Department.
It's a really great relief to those who otherwise would have been fighting for years and years and years with their insurance company over these bills that run into the tens of thousands of dollars.
Anderson says now, if patients in New York get a surprise bill, they're no longer responsible for it. Instead, it's up to the insurer and the provider to reach a payment deal through an independent mediation process. Dr. Andrew Kleinman with New York's Medical Society says everyone agrees that patients shouldn't be liable, but getting all the groups to agree on actual rules was really hard. Doctors, for example, worried it could result in much lower payments.
Therefore, this became, you know, very difficult to sell to physicians until we really worked out the details.
Even when patients aren't protected by state law, they may still have some recourse. Hoadley with Georgetown says as uncomfortable as it may be, patients may need to be their own negotiators.
The first rule of thumb is don't just pay the bill when you first get it if it doesn't seem right. Start asking questions. Did you really mean to send me that bill? You know, I did all these things right. I have insurance. What can we work out?
That is exactly what Michael Trost and Susan Rosalski did.
Then these were my letters.
Susan spent a lot of time making phone calls, writing letters, filing appeals. At first, it seemed like they'd be responsible for most of that $32,000 bill.
It was sickening. It was sickening.
She contacted her area representative in Pennsylvania and regulators in New York, because Susan works in New York, and that's where Michael got his care. It was through that process that she learned about New York's new law. It took effect on a very significant day for them.
The very day that I had my surgery.
It took place on April 1st.
That spurred even more calls and questions. But a few weeks ago, their insurer, United Healthcare, stated that Michael and Susan would not be responsible for the bill, and that the insurer will now take it up with the provider as outlined under that new law.
Oh, it's a huge relief.
I was just like, yes, yes. And I just felt so happy.
Michael and Susan say the whole experience will have them asking more questions about their care and their coverage in the future. All the while, policymakers and health groups have their eye on New York's new law to see how well it works moving forward. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Couldn't somebody develop an Are You in My Network app that we could access right in the ER with every new doctor who walks in? Perhaps Google and its newly formed parent company Alphabet could lead the charge. Here's what Google founders Larry Page and Sergey Brin said about this big move on their blog. We did a lot of crazy things that seemed crazy at the time. Many of those crazy things now have over a billion users. So the big question, of course, is what crazy things will they do next under the Alphabet umbrella? There's already a big emphasis on healthcare and technology with Google, and joining us now is Farzad Mastashari. He's a physician, he's worked in health IT for the government, and now he heads a health tech company called Alledate. Farzad, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
What are some of the health-related things Google is already doing?
Well, there's a lot of interaction, obviously, with all the devices that we use and the searches. And then there's some very specific, in that alphabet soup, there are some very specific companies that they're now going to have stand on their own. One of them looks at things like glucose sensing contact lens innovations. Another thing looks at extending life. For me, I think what's been interesting is the question, you know, why haven't these internet companies been more engaged in healthcare before now? It's almost one out of every $5 spent in the economy on anything. And at some point, you're going to come face to face with healthcare, and you're going to see how broken the current system is. And folks who work at Google and I think Silicon Valley more broadly, there's a sense of we can fix it, you know, techno-futurism and techno-perfectionism, that technology can cure the world's ills. And so it's almost a surprise that we haven't seen it more.
Why do you think that is? Why not more?
I think the first part has been historically that this new economy runs on data. And even though healthcare produces just an enormous amount of information and data, you know, if as long as it was on dead trees, there wasn't much you could do with it. And the switch from healthcare going from paper to digital with electronic medical records, I think, is a big part of now why there's just much more oxygen in the air for information technology companies to use that data for developing new advances. The other challenge, though, and I'm not sure this one is going to go away, is that healthcare is a highly regulated industry. There are many protections in healthcare. The whole idea of, you know, we'll move fast and break things doesn't work so well when it's life and death at stake. And, you know, it's really hard to imagine a 12-person healthcare company that becomes worth $1 billion, like, you know, WhatsApp. Because one of the things that our company has realized is if you have data and analytics and technology and cloud-based technology, that's great. That lets you do things you couldn't do before, but you still need to get out to the doctor's office and change the workflows, change how they integrate this technology into their practices, into taking better care of patients.
What could you see as some product that could really revolutionize our lives when it comes to healthcare and how it's delivered?
You know, I used to say that it's transactional, like buying shoes. You know, when you get sick, you walk in the door of the doctor's office and it goes jingle, jingle. And the doctor's office person says, can I help you, right? Or it's equivalent. And it's transactional. It's prompt. It's reactive. And then someone said, no, we don't sell shoes that way anymore. It's much more, the shoe store has much more of an enduring relationship with understanding you and your preferences and when you might be in the market again and what kind of shoes you like than your doctor's office does. That has to change. knowing your patients, knowing when your patients go into the hospital, when they leave the hospital, when they visited the emergency room, when they picked up or didn't pick up their medication, who needs my help today? And it may not be the 20 or 30 people who are showing up today to be seen. There may be 20 or 30 people who are sitting at home or just got discharged from the hospital or sitting in rehab or sitting in an emergency room who need my help today. And bringing that that engagement, that relationship between, for example, a primary care physician and that patient, making that last outside of that brief office encounter, that to me is the dream of how we can integrate technology and analytics into the care relationship. And that's if there's one thing that I believe so firmly in, is the data and analytics and technology are fantastic, and they scale and they let us do things we could never do before. But that has to be built on top of and not around, not instead of, not replacing the personal relationship, the healing relationship.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Aledade CEO Farzad Mastashari, he's a physician and the former National Coordinator for Health IT at the Department of Health and Human Services. And Farzad just described how healthcare is its own animal. Innovations that revolutionize shoe shopping don't necessarily work when it comes to something as intimate and important as our health. Take the massive organ shortage in America. 120,000 people are waiting for kidneys, livers, hearts, or other transplants. And the gap between the number of available organs and patients on the waiting list keeps getting bigger. How could this be fixed? Some are proposing a very controversial free market approach, paying donors for their organs. There's no shortage of sperm or egg donors, right? Todd Bookman reports.
It's one thing to talk about organ donations. It's another thing to actually need one. That's the position Sally Sittel found herself in after being diagnosed with end-stage renal disease in 2004. Her kidneys were rapidly failing, and years of dialysis loomed while she inched her way up the transplant list. That is, unless she could secure an organ from a friend or relative.
It was a very, very difficult and, frankly, unusual time. I mean, you're basically in a position of asking people for a body part.
After several false starts, what she calls near-transplant experiences, an acquaintance on the other side of the country proved a willing match. The donor received nothing more than profound gratitude. But the experience left Sittel, a psychiatrist and lecturer at the Yale School of Medicine, frustrated by the country's transplant system and organ shortage. In the 1980s, a federal law set up the structure. It placed a strict ban on compensating donors and relied purely on altruism.
I can understand why we started that way in 1984, but 3 decades later, it's clear that it's a qualified failure.
To increase the number of transplants, Sittel is calling for an end to what has long been seen as taboo in the field. In a recent essay in the Journal of the American Medical Association, she proposes a pilot program that would give living donors, people who give a kidney or a portion of their liver, around $50,000 in the form of a tax credit, scholarship, or 401k-type contribution. The payment wouldn't come from the recipient, but instead from Medicare, which in theory saves money by decreasing the number of people on dialysis. And the concept has its backers.
We have to stop writing about it and actually do it.
David Goldberg runs the liver donation program for the University of Pennsylvania Hospital System. He says financial incentives aren't just about attracting more donors. Instead, it's about compensating the friends or relatives who are already interested but can't go through with it because of money problems. Donating an organ often means missing a fair amount of work, and many families can't handle that financially.
There have been times where we have decided that we would not go forward because we could not risk putting a potential donor and his family and his kids, who are living paycheck to paycheck, at risk of going into debt and, you know, losing their home even.
It's unclear exactly how many extra organs an incentive system would free up for donation. That's why they want to do the trial. But even if it's sizable, that doesn't mean everybody likes the idea. Howard Nathan is longtime CEO of the nonprofit Gift of Life, based in Philadelphia. He's giving me a tour of what amounts to mission control for organ donations in the region.
But this call center is the heartbeat of everything that we do. The calls from the hospitals come here to refer us potential donors. Organs that are being offered from other cities come here so that we can offer those to local patients. Tissue and eye donation, all that is done in this transplant information center 24/7.
Back in 1994, he played a big role in crafting what was, at the time, a groundbreaking Pennsylvania law. It was the first to give a small stipend, about $300, to the family of a deceased organ donor. The money would go directly to a funeral home to pay for burial expenses. But just before being implemented, state officials got cold feet over concerns it violated the federal ban on compensation, and they pulled the plug.
I guess we were pretty naive. I think the idea was, is we thought this made good sense.
Nathan still likes the idea of a funeral voucher because it acknowledges the family's contribution to society. It's like a thank you gift. But the idea of a $50,000 payment, ethically, that doesn't sit well with him, especially since it could result in a lot of poorer people giving organs to wealthier ones.
Could a trial take place? And could the trial take place so that people have some sort of rewarded gifting? I might be in favor of that. But I think the key is when it gets to be a significant amount of money, then I guess it really is repugnant of, you know, you're buying and selling organs.
There's a line here between what's expressing gratitude and what comes off as a bribe. And for each person, that line gets drawn in a different place. Sally Satel has laid out her position and is now a leading voice in creating an incentive system. But she faces an uphill struggle. Before any trial program gets launched, she'll need to first convince federal lawmakers it's the right thing to do. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
Coming up, bend over, but not like that.
Not bend from your neck, not curve your back, but always make every bend a hinge, or you could say every bend is a bow.
Could we avoid back pain by changing our posture and movement? Stay tuned to The Pulse.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca strives to offer employees a vibrant, stimulating, and collaborative work environment. AstraZeneca aims to foster a culture that puts patients first, promotes scientific curiosity, values the power of diversity, and ultimately attracts, develops, and retains great people. Learn more about career opportunities with AstraZeneca at AstraZeneca.com/careers.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. That's why they're proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches, to help keep you healthy. And it's why they're proud to sponsor programs and events around the city like the Blue Cross Broad Street Run and Indigo, Philadelphia's first bike share program. More at IBX.com and RideIndigo.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Aching backs, tight shoulders, stiff necks, such are the plagues of modern humans who spend so much of their time hunched over desks and computers. And some people are spending big bucks to learn better body alignment. There's the Feldenkrais method, there's the Alexander technique. Movement re-education promises to release tension and make you more mindful of your posture. For this edition of our segment, Lab Rat, reporter Tanya English tried out the Goclay method. Trainers teach students to use their muscles differently to sit, stand, and walk. Let's see how Tanya did.
I start out by complaining to movement teacher Roberta Cooks. My back doesn't hurt really, but I worry about what my long commute is doing to my health. I'm in the car, then I sit on an Amtrak train for an hour and 40 minutes. And finally head to the subway, carrying a laptop and 13 pounds of recording equipment.
I get to Philadelphia and I go down the steps with my big bag and my purse and sometimes an overnight bag. And I'm just always adjusting these bags on my back.
Yes. So, I mean, one thing is to think about is how much do you have to take, right?
Cooks is a psychiatrist by training, but she now teaches Goclay full time. After listening patiently for a bit, she takes a few pictures of me with her phone.
Here is you standing up. That's a sway in the middle of your back.
The human spine is shaped like an S. That's just normal anatomy. But Gokhale practitioners say that despite that S-curve, for thousands of years, humans held our bodies differently, with a much straighter back. Cook says modern Western people have lost that primal posture.
If you look at old photographs before 1920, people, you think of your ancestors from that time, you probably look at those photos and think, those people look so stiff. But actually, they were showing good posture. That's how they were. They weren't doing it just for the camera.
Today, it's our habit to hunch and slouch through life.
Coco Chanel made it fashionable to slump. Think of her with a cigarette and sort of in this magnified S-curve.
She says the lesson begins with proper shoulder position. So I shove mine back, stiff like a soldier. But that's wrong.
When you pull them back, what are you using to hold them there?
My upper back muscles.
Your upper back muscles. And what happens if you keep holding them there for a long time?
There's going to be a pain in my upper back muscles.
Exactly. And then what happens if you forget about it? They go right back where they were, right?
A shoulder roll is a kinder way to open the chest and avoid pinching the nerves and blood vessels that send oxygen and nutrients down the arms.
So we're doing it one shoulder at a time, a little forward, a little up, a lot back, and a lot down, and then just relax. Okay.
The right shoulder first, and then the left.
A little forward?
A little forward, a little up, a lot back, and rotate and down.
Cook says the Gokhale method is preventive medicine for all sorts of aches and pains.
Things like repetitive stress injuries and carpal tunnel syndrome and things going on with your elbow.
She also believes in the psychological benefits of something called power posing.
When you have your shoulders back, you are actually making less cortisol, less stress hormone, and more testosterone. You end up feeling calmer and more confident just by having your shoulders back.
A psychologist at Harvard University uncovered that general link between posture and biochemistry. But so far, there's no gold standard research on the health effects of the Gokhale method. But even without evidence, I'm willing to try.
Good. Supported and a little bit stretched, maybe.
Cook places a small beanbag on the top of my head, and instinctively, I push up against it and lengthen the back of my neck.
Does that feel okay?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
With my ribs tucked, my back seems broader. I'm breathing deeply and sitting straighter.
So there it is. Yes.
Cook guides me to keep my back straight and pivot forward at the waist.
But just move from the hips.
Hinge.
Hinge is exactly right. And that's actually the way I want you to always bend from now on. Not bend from your neck, not curve your back, but always make every bend a hinge, or you could say every bend is a bow.
Next, she gets me up to try glide walking.
Bum,
the whole movement begins with the muscles in my upper glutes.
Push off, push off. You know, in graduation or the wedding march, you go, you push off and then your legs stay together for a moment. There's a pause. Think of people in these non-industrialized countries. They're often walking like 30 miles or something back, and they have stuff on their head and a baby on their back, and it's just amazing. But because they do this walk and have a rest in each step, it also gives them this amazing endurance and also ability to sort of feel relaxed in the walk. Good, good. Do you feel it, Tanya?
I'm not so sure that it's actually preventive medicine or that I'd pay $75 for a class, but I do feel it.
And you're beautiful and regal and confident.
Okay. After all that positive reinforcement, a week later, I'm still doing shoulder rolls on my commute to work, stretching my neck tall, and making little adjustments throughout the day. I do feel lighter, but maybe it's just because I finally cleaned out my equipment bag and dumped the stuff I didn't need. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
I'm rolling my shoulders back right now, but there's always that pesky too-good-to-be-true issue. Did our ancestors or other cultures really have better posture and less back pain? We called up Bruce Latimer. He is an anatomy professor at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, and he studies fossils to understand how humans evolved to walk the way they do.
So it's a long-standing problem, and that's make a pun there. And it can't be solved by simply saying, you know, stand with a different posture. That isn't going to work. I've looked at a lot of pre-contact American native skeletons, And arthritis in the spine is everywhere. It's not as though they had no back pain.
He says bad posture is not the big problem, but he calls the S-curve in our back a mechanical nightmare. Imagine the vertebrae and discs are 24 porcelain cups and saucers, jerry-rigged on top of each other, and then try to balance your big, heavy head on top.
That's what evolution has done to the human spine.
Of course, evolution also enables us to walk around upright and balanced, so I suppose back pain and herniated discs are downsides we have to deal with, one shoulder roll at a time. The quest to avoid the many health perils of modern life has brought some office dwellers to the standing desk, because we've all heard how sitting is poison, right? Recent research has linked sitting too much with heart problems, diabetes, even increased cancer risk. But here's the thing. Standing desks come with problems of their own. Anna Medeiros-Miller is joining us now. She's a health and wellness reporter for U.S. News and World Report, and she's been following standing desks for some time. Anna, thank you so much for being on The Pulse.
Thanks for inviting me.
What are some mistakes people are making while using standing desks?
So standing desks have a lot of potential, but you have to use them correctly to be able to reap the benefits. So one of the problems is if you trade sitting all day for simply standing all day, really the issue is that you're not moving. And the risks associated with that are not necessarily the same, but they could be equally as bad for you.
What about posture? Are we doing any better just because we're standing up, or are we perhaps hurting our backs?
It could go either way. So if you're very cognizant of your posture and you're standing up straight and you have your shoulders back and you're not leaning to one side or the other, then you might be doing your body some favors. But how many of us do that? The same way that when we're sitting, how many of us use a very healthy posture? So if you don't have your desk adjusted properly, you're going to set yourself up for a whole new host of problems. So you might have a certain pain or kink when you're sitting in the one position. Well, you're just going to have a new pain or kink if you stand in a position that's not correct. So you really need to make sure you have adjusted your desk to the appropriate height for you. And not all of the desks have that kind of capability where there's a lot of flexibility. One person I talked to suggested that maybe you stand up when you're talking on the phone or having a meeting or some way that you can incorporate standing or better yet walking into your workflow that doesn't necessarily still involve you staring at the computer and craning your neck.
A lot of people get standing desks because we've been told that standing burns more calories. So it seems like, ooh, I can be at work and lose weight at the same time. Mm. Is that really true?
It is true. Standing does burn about 20% more calories than sitting, but it's probably not the best reason to get a standing desk. If you're standing, you are going to get tired more quickly. So, you know, I always think about the other professions that do have to stand all day. So you think about medical professionals or people in retail or in the restaurant business, and they look at those of us with desk jobs getting standing desks as crazy because they're trying to find any time that they can get to take a load off and sit down. So if there's some way that we can kind of find a balance so that we're not straining our body too much in any one position, and it's probably better yet to just go out, take a walk, maybe for 20 minutes in the afternoon if you can. Maybe I talked to one guy who does squats while he is waiting for his lunch to microwave. So there's a lot of other ways you can incorporate movement into your workday that will probably burn those calories a lot faster and more successfully than slowly over the course of the day if you're simply standing.
What about your feet? I'm wondering if you're standing all day long, doesn't that spell foot pain and swollen feet at the end of the day?
Yeah, it can. I think it's also really important, especially for women, to remember that if you're going to go for the standing desk, then make sure that you have appropriate footwear. You can really hurt your feet and, in effect, hurt your back, your hips, your whole alignment can get off if you are not wearing the appropriate footwear. And a lot of women, if they're going to work, are going to want to wear heels or want to wear some nice footwear that is a lot more comfortable to be sitting down in. So what you can do is maybe have a pair of shoes that's comfortable, flat, has a lot of support, even sneakers, if you don't mind how they look, to change into once you get to work, or if you're lucky enough to work in an environment that encourages that all day, then go for it.
What about the desk itself? I've been seeing a lot of do-it-yourself models that are cobbled together from different IKEA items. And then there are really expensive standing desks that can cost a couple of $1,000s. Have you learned anything about the models and what we should be looking for?
You know, I don't think it's actually such a bad idea to go for the cheap ones. What I do sometimes is find a bookshelf and just prop my computer up on the shelf that fits my laptop, that fits well with my stance, and do that for maybe a half hour and then move my laptop down to my desk. And that kind of makeshift situation can at least help you understand whether or not this is something you want to invest in.
And generally speaking, it sounds like from what you've learned in your reporting, a mixed approach seems the most reasonable. Standing sometimes, sitting sometimes, walking around when you can.
Right. I think it's important to remember that we talk about sedentary behavior being really terrible for us, and that's true. But somehow in the message, it's gotten a little bit switched to sedentary behavior equaling sitting. And there's a lot of things that we can do that are sedentary that aren't necessarily sitting, whether it's laying down on the couch or standing in a still behavior. So the standing desk isn't necessarily the end-all be-all.
Anna, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Anna Medeiros-Miller is a health and wellness reporter at U.S. News and World Report. Coming up, you see a needle, you see blood, and you faint.
All the blood now rushes into our massive, fully dilated lower extremities, and not enough is left to go up to the brain.
We'll explore this phenomenon. Stay tuned to The Pulse.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca strives to create a culture where employees are excited by their work, have a clear sense of purpose, and display confidence in their ability to meet challenges and seize opportunities. More at AstraZeneca.com/careers.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. They are proud to offer health programs including fitness reimbursements and health coaches. IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Sometimes our own experiences become inspirations for the reports you hear on the show. Carolyn Beeler is here now. Hi, Carolyn.
Hey, Mike.
And Carolyn, you sort of almost literally fell into a story when you were in a hospital recently. So what happened?
Yes, I was visiting a family member in the hospital, and he was getting a lumbar puncture, which entails a very long needle going into the base of the spine. And I wanted to watch this procedure. I wanted to stay in the room. The doctor administering the procedure looked at me kind of skeptically and said, you know, are you sure you don't want to sit down or leave the room? I don't want to have to call a code on you because you pass out and faint. And I said, no, I'm going to be fine. You know, I've given blood. I'm not afraid of needles. But I'll stand by the door just in case I need to leave. So the needle started going in and I was fine. And then suddenly I started to feel woozy and dizzy and nauseous and my skin got clammy and I got tunnel vision and I knew I was going to pass out if I couldn't sit down like right now. So I left the room and sat down and all of this went away. And I thought, what's happening in my body? This seems like the worst reaction to have when a loved one is potentially in pain, to want to pass out.
Had you ever fainted before?
No, and that's why I was curious about what was happening. So I went on a quest to find out. My first stop was Dr. Dan Frisch, a cardiologist at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital who specializes in arrhythmias.
The reason you got woozy and the reason that some people faint in those types of situations is actually a reflex.
So when something surprises you or startles you, you go into this fight or flight response and your adrenaline just spikes.
All of a sudden they get a little bit jittery, their eyes get wider, they become hyper aware of things. So the classic example would be the tiger chasing you. Perhaps if you're a caveman, that'll get your blood pressure up, that'll get your heart rate going, and you'll run pretty fast and be hyper aware of your surroundings.
This revving up is what's called your sympathetic nervous system kicking into gear. And then the way it's supposed to work is that when that threat has passed, an opposite reaction, the parasympathetic nervous system, then kicks into gear to chill your body out, to lower your blood pressure and your heart rate.
Say you've captured that tiger and made it into a meal. At the conclusion of your meal, that feeling of being a little bit sedated or drowsy, that's mediated more by the parasympathetic nervous system.
And it's the parasympathetic nervous system that kicks into gear when you have this woozy reaction, right?
Ultimately, that's what gets you.
So these two systems are supposed to balance each other out. They're sort of like yin and yang. But what happens when you get woozy is that the parasympathetic reaction is totally winning out. It's just clobbering the first fight or flight response. Your blood pressure gets just too low. Eventually, not enough oxygen is getting to your brain, and it starts to shut down, and then you pass out.
Is this just a malfunction, or is there any purpose for fainting?
So this I was still not very clear on. So Dr. Frisch sent me to a colleague of his who's really interested in sort of the evolutionary reasons behind this phenomenon.
I'm just going to call him directly. Hi, Behzad. Behzad, I'm sending a reporter over to your office.
He sent me down the street to the arrhythmia clinic and his colleague, Dr. Behzad Pavri. And he told me that the reason we faint when our blood pressure drops, it's all about humans' ongoing battle with gravity. We're one of the few animals whose heads are far above our hearts, so it takes a lot of work for our hearts to keep pumping blood up into our heads.
So you may ask, why is it that we have this problem? If you're talking about head being above the heart, think of the giraffe. It ought to be fainting all the time. But it doesn't.
Giraffes don't faint?
No, they don't. This is a problem that is unique to the human species. So the question is why?
Pavri says doctors have a few ideas about things that are unique to humans that may help answer that why question.
Number one, we are the species with the greatest northbound load. We have to push one-fifth of our cardiac output up to our big oxygen-requiring brains. Number two, we have the most powerful lower extremities on the planet.
Our legs can hold a ton of blood, so when our blood vessels dilate in this rest and digest reaction,
and all the blood now rushes into our massive, fully dilated lower extremities, and not enough is left to go up to the brain.
And there's a third reason: we can lock our knees, which can prevent blood from being pumped back up into our hearts.
We've been upright as a species for millions of years, so how come we haven't outgrown this fainting problem over the years?
This was sort of one of my central questions, and Pavri says there are some reasons why this fainting might be beneficial to us.
When this happens to a person, they look like they died. They drain of blood from their face, they become completely pale, they are limp and unconscious on the floor, immobile. You can imagine how an aggressor might think the person's dead and walk away.
There's also an idea that this could protect your heart during a stressful situation, and it could prevent you from bleeding out if it's actually your blood that you're seeing because, say, that tiger you were chasing for dinner ended up biting off your arm.
This reflex kicks in at the sight of blood or with pain, and it makes my blood pressure go to zero, basically. I faint, but while my blood pressure is low, it gives the bleeding limb a chance to clot.
And so why would this happen when I see somebody else get a shot or I see somebody else bleeding, when neither of those evolutionary benefits would be helpful? In fact, it maybe would be helpful for me to be able to fight off
Correct.
The person
That's
giving.
A very obvious and great question. But the problem is we really don't know. This is a reflex that has multiple triggers that initiate it. They all have the same end result, drop in blood pressure and a slowing of the heart rate. But why these particular triggers start the reflex is really unknown.
It could just be that a needle is a needle, whether it's coming at you or somebody else. One psychologist I talked to chalked this phenomenon up to unconscious empathy baked into all of us humans.
And why does this happen to some people but not others?
So women and children are more likely to have this reaction because they have lower blood volume circulating. People who are afraid of blood are more likely to faint if they're giving blood. But there is something you can do about it. Being exposed over and over to blood and needles can help reduce this reaction. And also there's a technique called applied tension where you tense your legs, arms, and torso to rev up your blood pressure before you see something that might make you faint.
Carolyn, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Megan.
Carolyn Beeler talking about a recent experience of almost fainting at the sight of a big needle.
You're listening to The Pulse. Imagine looking at amazing space simulations all day long. Stars exploding, galaxies forming, crashing together, lighting up. And this is part of your job. It's a dream come true for Haverford College astronomy professor Deshika Narayanan. He recently sat down for our series, So What Do You Do? Down-to-Earth Conversations About Science. And consultant Neil Barton asked him,
So what do you do?
I study theoretical galaxy formation, and so I do mostly computational work. I develop large-scale simulations to try to understand how galaxies form from the Big Bang all the way through today. So say I wonder, well, what happens to a disk galaxy like the Milky Way, and how does it evolve? How does it form, and how does it evolve? Well, you'll set up some simulation where you start a universe or a small subsection of the universe off with some sort of initial conditions that you think may have existed after the Big Bang. So you have some idea of what the dark matter distribution looks like and maybe where the gas is. Then you have some idea of what the basic equations of physics are that you learned in graduate school, starting with F equals ma, which is one of the most basic physics equations you learn, and layering on in complexity from there. And then you press go on the computer and you let it evolve.
And I guess I'm wondering, what does the output look like? Do you end up looking at one number or a set of a dozen numbers, or is it a table, or do you get pretty pictures, or all of these things?
Yeah, that's a great question. So you actually get all of these things. The numbers are useful, but it's oftentimes, you know, not as telling as actually looking at the movie and seeing what happens, or looking at the images over a number of different viewing angles, or flying into the image to see what is actually going on with your eyes.
So you can, like, manipulate the movie output, or you just get one straight feature, as it were, that you have to watch?
No, so you'll actually manipulate the output. So one thing you can imagine, for example, is the Milky Way, the galaxy we live in, is on a crash course with Andromeda, our nearest major galaxy neighbor. So some number of billion years into the future, we're going to bang into Andromeda. So one question you could imagine asking is, what's going to happen to the solar system? Are we going to be in trouble? Are we going to get ejected from the galaxy? Are we going to stay where we are, et cetera? So you can run simulations where you'll bang two galaxies together, and collaborators of mine have done this. And so you bang two galaxies together, and you put in a test particle somewhere where the Earth is, roughly. And you see what happens to it. And it turns out there's actually a high probability that we'll get flung out of the galaxy.
What is the most exciting thing that you've discovered recently about how galaxies work, or the most controversial topic that you've thought about?
I think they're probably the same topic or the same answer. There's a class of galaxies in the early universe. The universe is 14 billion years old, we think. There's this class of galaxies that lives roughly 2 to 3 billion years after the Big Bang, which turns out to be a super active time in the universe. There's tons of stars forming, which means there's going to be tons of light everywhere, and there's tons of galaxies that are in a very interesting phase of their evolution. And there's this class of galaxies that people have discovered over the last 20 years that are the brightest galaxies in the universe. They're over 100 times and many hundreds of times brighter than our own galaxy. To put it into context, our own galaxy, the Milky Way, forms something like 1 or 2 suns per year. These galaxies form 1 or 2,000 suns per year. So they're very active places.
Yeah.
And nobody knows where they come from. The predominant school of thought is that these galaxies owe to big collisions of galaxies, sort of like the way the Milky Way is going to collide with Andromeda. It turns out, at least in our local neighborhood, when we see galaxies bang together, they become really bright and they form a ton of stars. And so my collaborators and I have developed a model in which we actually don't think they're galaxy mergers, but rather really rich environments where there's tons and tons of galaxies all smushed into a fairly, I mean, in a relative sense, small area. And that what you're observing is a bunch of galaxies contributing to the light and not one particular system, which I think would in some ways rewrite the book on this particular phenomenon that people have been observing for 20, 25 years.
What's been the reaction to that? Are people throwing things at you at conferences or writing papers in response?
That's the exact phrase I use. I say, I give this talk at a conference and tomatoes start to hit me in the face. I've been talking about this at conferences for about a year. The paper was just recently accepted a few weeks ago. So,
nice.
You know, at least personally, I very much dislike going to a conference, giving a talk, and having everyone say, oh yeah, we agree. That's boring, right? You want someone to push back on you because you want there to be continued problems in the field that get you excited and make you want to work on the problem more. And so it is very exciting to go to conferences in different sub areas and try to present your results and see how people come at it from different angles.
Right. You want to stimulate people from your own area of research as well as people from other somewhat related or totally unrelated areas, and then you can all build off of each other.
Exactly.
Deshika, thanks for talking to me about your research and what it is that you do.
Thank you. I very much enjoy this.
Deshika Narayanan is a professor of astronomy at Haverford College. He spoke with Neil Bardhan. He's a consultant and he also loves improv comedy. Do you want to be part of our So What Do You Do series? Maybe you're a scientist or maybe you're somebody who is curious about science and likes to ask questions. We're always looking for people to participate, so email us. We're at thepulse@whyy.org. And that's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Joel Patterson, the managing editor. Megan Pinto is our executive producer. Chris Satullo is vice president of news. Did you miss some of this show or any of our previous shows? Just subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes or you can find it at our website at whyy.org/thepulse. That's also where you can get in touch with us. Send us an email. Do you have any questions or ideas for upcoming shows? We always love to hear from you. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.